Welcome to episode 2 of the Edisto TV podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region. Here are our hosts, Hugo and Tom.
Welcome once again to the Edisto TV podcast. This is the second episode. If you missed the first episode, it is archived. You can go back and listen to how it all started. I'm Hugo. I'm here with Tom. And to start today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Surface Water Withdrawal Act and how the Farm Bureau has started to play a role in the conversation. Tom, can you tell me, when did you first become aware that Farm Bureau had a hand to play in this?
Well, it was when we were beginning to try to contact our legislators and about this Surface Water Withdrawal Act, when we read this and realized that this, you know, had this huge ag exemption, as we've been calling it, we started calling our legislators and asking them what they thought. And everybody said, oh, no, everything's good. The farmers are good with it. Everybody's good with this law. All the environmental groups got on board. And what we're finding, though, is that, you know, in order to get this law to pass, you know, Farm Bureau pretty much insisted on an exemption for agriculture. And of course, everybody loves farmers. Everybody wants to support farmers. And as a result, this huge loophole exists. And I think from the environmental people that I've talked to, they said that they really just never imagined an entity of this size wanting to take that much water from a river like the Edisto River. And so that's, and so Farm Bureau all of a sudden became our target as to, like, well, why are they pushing that?
Yeah, I guess when Farm Bureau first sort of came to the forefront of my awareness in any of this was at the point when they launched their Save SC Farmers website and started doing this really heavy campaign where they were saying that people were radical environmental extremists. And, I mean, there was a lot of heated language in what they were putting out there. And at the time, I was kind of surprised that that was happening. You know, since then, we've learned a lot more about what their position is. We actually, back on Good Friday, went and sat down with some of the folks from Farm Bureau, with a few farmers from around Wagner. Doug Busby was there. I was there. I think you had another commitment. But the meeting was quite interesting. The Farm Bureau is very definitely saying that they are in favor of being good stewards of resources, which is a positive thing. It's just that they view the values at stake in all of this maybe differently than we do. So I hope that as we go forward with them, that what we're looking at is less confrontational, less oppositional, and more all of us with the goal of being good stewards, finding ways to work together towards that. I will say that based on the meeting there, I didn't see them leaping forward to support changes in the law. But, you know, it was the starting place for a conversation. I know Doug Busby, I think, is going to be checking in with us by phone at some point during this podcast. So maybe that's something that you can include in your conversation with him. Anything else on the Farm Bureau topic you want to touch on before we move along?
Well, just that Save SC Farmers thing is still going on. I mean, even though they may not be as bold and, you know, putting the word out quite as much, they're still buying ads and they're still actively campaigning to identify farmers who have water needs. And, you know, I think what's happening, my impression of what's happening is they really overstepped when they attacked everyone who opposes this law as radical environmental extremists, because what they didn't realize was that there are a lot of Farm Bureau customers, a lot of rural people, a lot of farmers that don't think a farmer should have the right to drain the river dry. And even though we all, you know, want to protect the river, you know, when you give somebody the right to do something, you know, somebody's going to come along and do it. And, you know, as Doug mentioned, it's kind of like not having a speed limit on Main Street. And it's not if there's going to be a problem, it's when there's going to be a problem. And so we want to try to stop this problem before it really becomes a major issue. And it's bound to happen.
Yeah, based on the conversation that we had on Good Friday, their position seems to be that we should give the law time to either work or not work. My problem with that is if the law doesn't work and the river gets damaged to the point that it can't recover, you know, how are they going to make that right again? And I don't know that there is a reasonable answer to that at hand, but I think a lot of conversation will go into exploring the options there.
Well, it's a mindset, and it reminds me of what DHEC said when we had that public meeting where they said basically if they damage the river, then we can actually go in and they said if they damage the river and they've exceeded their water withdrawal limit. So in other words, we're not thinking that we should wait until, you know, a disaster and then go back and try to fix it. We think we should we see a disaster coming in the future if we don't do something. So we need to go ahead and get on board and do it now. And one of the things we've been doing lately that we've never done before is going to these like political type events where, you know, conservation voters or some of these others that will, you know, host legislators. And so we've had an opportunity to talk to dozens of legislators. And it blows my mind how many of them just have no idea about this. And so part of what we're trying to do with the podcast and the website and everything else is get the word out so legislators can get on board. When people hear the truth about this law, they're just shocked.
Yeah, and I think something to consider as we're really doing this podcast to reach out to the grassroots, the folks who were first interested in what we had to say on Edisto Concerns, for example. Those folks, it's great that we're talking to each other and that the word is spreading at the grassroots level, but if there's any single thing that everybody out there who's listening can do that's going to help is, yes, reach out to your representatives at the local and state level and let them know that this is an important issue to you and that the Surface Water Withdrawal Act needs to be changed so that it accomplishes what it was intended to do.
And I would add to that, if you're a farmer or if you know a farmer, and particularly if they have anything to do with Farm Bureau, they need to talk to Farm Bureau, because one of the things we learned through this that we didn't know before is Farm Bureau is a hugely powerful lobby, and they have a lot of money and a lot of resources, and pretty much what we're hearing is that the legislators will do what Farm Bureau tells them to do because they believe Farm Bureau speaks for farmers. Well, I'm starting to think they don't speak for farmers, and I think they're starting to see that there's definitely a rift there, and they don't speak for all farmers, and some farmers don't mind a little bit of legislation to protect our natural resources.
That's right. And if people want to follow up on some of the stuff we've been talking about in terms of reaching out to legislators and so forth, I know Edisto Concerns has a couple of links where you can figure out who your local legislator is and send email. Snail mail always makes a difference, too. They open those letters and they sit on their desks. It seems like maybe they have a bit more weight than a piece of electronic mail. So definitely, if this is an issue that is near and dear to your heart, please take the time, reach out to your legislators, let them know how you feel about it. This should be an issue that transcends politics. It shouldn't be a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It is simply an issue for anybody who has a stake in the future of water resources in the state of South Carolina.
You're listening to the Edisto TV podcast.
And I guess while we got you and while we're on this topic, I was wondering if maybe you could just share, you know, this trip to Farm Bureau. I thought was quite amazing because they seem to be, you know, dead set against us and what we were doing and bringing attention to this water issue. But, you know, I have to give credit to Doug mostly for continuing to want to talk, continuing to want to work things out. And somehow or another, you managed to get right up there to the Farm Bureau office and talk to Mr. Winkles and his whole crew. So can you just tell me your general impressions about that visit and how it went?
I can. The way the thing came together was Doug Busby had been reaching out to Farm Bureau trying to have a chance to just get with them and see if there was any common ground at all that we could establish, any basis for future conversations, possibly directed towards finding solutions that can work for everybody on these issues. The folks there, David Winkles is the president of Farm Bureau. Several of his board members were there. A couple of his lobbyists were there. And on our side of the table, we had Doug Busby. There was me. There were several farmers from the Wagoner area. There was a past president of the FFA, the state FFA. So we all sat down around the table and started out by talking about what our concerns were and asking the folks from Farm Bureau to explain or expand upon what their objections were to the idea of changing the surface water withdrawal law. And they have, as you said, a big lobbying function that I was previously fairly unaware of. And they have apparently spent a number of years working with a lot of environmental organizations and a lot of legislators to come to the existing surface water withdrawal law, which was passed in 2010. And apparently there's 6-8 years of history leading to that, and it was done with the best of intentions. But as you say, the farm lobby worked hard, and I'm going to say this as I understand it, to make sure that farmers were not burdened by the new regulations. They were trying to avoid a situation where a small farmer was going to have an obstacle that was unreasonable to conducting his business and growing whatever it was he grew. And with that as their sort of rallying cry, what you were calling exemption before, what it led to was a sort of bifurcation, a fork in the road of how these water withdrawal projects are put forward. So if you're a municipality or if you're an industry, you go through the permit process. The permit process includes all sorts of things that are not in the agricultural registration process. The permit process involves public notice, public hearings. It involves consultations between agencies. The person making the permit request has to have a plan B, so that they have a way of supplying water if for some reason river water might not be available. There are more stringent environmental inquiries done into the effect of the withdrawals. Unfortunately, even for municipal and industrial takings, it's still this safe yield analysis based on the annual mean. But there's a lot more there on the industrial and municipal side than on the ag side.
But what's interesting is that the amount of water that was approved for the Walther Farms was actually more than the city of Aiken.
Right. But, I mean, it was a lot of water. But the way this thing is set up in the law, what happens is they do the safe yield analysis, right? And based on the safe yield analysis, they hold back 20% of the annual mean average flow. And the other 80% is eligible for surface water withdrawal by whomever. And it really, you know, whether it's one gigantic user who takes 80% or 5,000 little users who take 80%, they're saying that there's 80% of the annual mean flow in the river that can be taken. And I don't have an issue with farmers. I don't have an issue with industry. I don't have an issue with municipalities. But they cannot say that that is a way of guaranteeing the health of the river. Because as we played from the DHEC meeting in last week's podcast, there is no provision in this law that says that you can't draw the river down to nothing. I would like to see this whole process work out sort of the way the conversation between Friends of the Edisto and the Walther Brothers operation did, where, you know, we started out with a lawsuit there and ended up finding a way to live together without going to court. I'd like to see a similar spirit of cooperation take hold in our relationship with Farm Bureau on this. Like I said before, it's not a political thing. It's not an anti-farmer thing. we all have a stake in the surface waters of South Carolina, and we want to see that protected.
Well, we're hoping that reason will prevail, but our first impression of the Farm Bureau position is pretty much no holds barred. I mean, their position is we don't want to be regulated. And I just don't think that's a good tenable position long term. And I hopefully they're going to hear enough from their people, their farmers, their members, that says, hey, you know what? Let's be responsible citizens and let's succumb to some regulation of some sort that will allow us to be good citizens and show our neighbors that we're good citizens and we care about these natural resources.
To be fair, Farm Bureau would say that they are operating under the existing law and that therefore they are agreeing to regulation, but I don't think you're wrong.
Right. Well, that brings up another point. We always say that they're exempt from the law, but what blew my mind was when I actually read the law, and I'm not a lawyer and I don't read laws very often, but when I read it, I kept looking for the exemption for agriculture. And when you look at the list of exemptions, there is no exemption for agriculture. So I called one of our conservation lawyer friends and said, where is this? I don't see it. Where is the exemption for agriculture? And well, what it turns out is that it's actually in a definition of registration or registrar or whatever it is exactly. But basically, to me, it's tricky because when they went back in and they had all the lawyer, the legislators look at this law and vote on it, I'm sure that they looked at this little bullet list of exemptions. And ag wasn't even on there. So to me, it was kind of a backhanded way. I guess I shouldn't question the motives of these people, but you could read this law and not even know there's an agricultural exemption.
For more information and archived podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.
Moving on now with the Edisto TV podcast, let's talk Edisto TV for a minute. I saw some pictures this week of you up on the water tower in Wagner. What was that all about?
Well, the town of Wagner has gotten on board with a new system where they're basically putting a wide area network throughout the city. Right now, they're not offering internet service, but they have that capability, and they're using all this Ubiquiti equipment that I've been talking about. And my friend Joel Jones from over in Lake City, he's had the contract to do that work, and so I had the opportunity to kind of go side by side with him and get up on the water tower and kind of take a look. And so it's exciting. I mean, we expect to be putting service up on some of these water towers, and so this is kind of a first step. And hopefully, you know, in the near future, we'll be putting our own equipment up on some of these water towers and offering very high speed, fiber quality, reliable internet with no limits.
All right. Now, when you say that it's going to be high quality internet with no limits, how's this different from like 4G on my phone or something like that? Because this is not a signal that is just floating in the air that anybody with a device can get, right? People are going to have some technology in their home that will let them access the internet.
Right. So the tower, it's similar, but it's not the same. So it does come from a tower, it does come through the air, but you'll need a receiver at your house, and they're about $150. And so what Joel does over there in Lake City is they basically, you pay your first month's subscription fee, and you get this $150 device, and you get fast internet. And so the reason I say it's fast is because it tends to be faster than DSL, and it's much more reliable, and it's also symmetrical, as we mentioned last week. It means you can uploads is pretty much the same as download speed, which makes a big difference, particularly for technical people like myself and you. And then when you ask me what's the difference between, you know, the biggest difference between Verizon and what AT&T are offering through the cellular networks is that they have really small limits. And so for $40-$50 a month, you're talking about like a 4 gigabyte data limit. Well, you download one HD movie, you probably blew your 4 gig limit. So what that means is you're fairly limited in what you can do. If you're just surfing the web, if you go to a few web pages, you do your Facebook.
Checking your email.
Checking your email, that kind of thing. If that's what you do, then you're probably fine on the Verizon or AT&T network.
Well, and that leads me to, what if that's not what you do? I mean, I know a lot of folks these days, including you, are sort of cutting the cable, and you're using the Roku box, I know, streaming a lot of content. And how would that work on a 4 gig a month plan?
Yeah, so there would be no bandwidth limit. So that's the key, is that if you want to, you know, watch Netflix, you know, Hulu, basically we've got rid of the cable. The only thing I miss is the live sports. So I can't watch Carolina football. I got to go borrow somebody's TV or go someplace to watch it. But really, for watching TV, watching movies, that kind of thing, you can do an awful lot with streaming. You got the Roku box, you got the Apple TV, you got the Google Chromecast. All these devices are kind of prepping the way for the future of TV. And so, but they require quite a bit of bandwidth. So if you're watching movies, you're downloading gigs and gigs worth of movies, you know, on a daily basis. So, you know, you gotta have, you can't have limits. You can't have a 4 gig or 8 gig limit. I mean, if you did that on a Verizon, on my Verizon plan, if I watched all my TV over my 4G Verizon plan, it would probably cost me $200-$300 a month.
Okay, so stepping away from the cell networks, how's it compared to like the satellite internet service that you can get? I know that folks I know who have tried to use the satellite stuff doesn't work with the voice over IP telephony stuff, and it doesn't really work for real-time applications like maybe gaming and stuff like that, right?
Right. It's something they call latency, and it just basically has to do with the distance between the satellite and you. And there's really nothing you can do about it. They keep improving the technology and the software and that kind of thing, but there's just kind of like this physics that you can't really get around. And that's the same thing with DSL. So, I mean, DSL, you know, you're using copper wires that were put in the ground probably in the 20s or 30s, and they just only going to get going so fast. And so, you know, satellite, everybody I know who's tried a satellite dish has hated it. And again, if you're just browsing, checking email, you might get by. But my goodness, you can't, don't plug your Xbox up. Don't try to watch a movie on there. You know, God forbid, don't try uploading your videos, Hugo. It's just not going to work. And so DSL is kind of the same. We've got the best service we can get right now. And I mean, for me to try to live the lifestyle I'm living with internet TV and, you know, website development and all this stuff, I mean, we're pushing it to the limit.
All right. And I understand that sometime soon your friend Joel is going to be joining us here on one of the podcasts to talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get Joel on the phone and he can kind of explain a little more about the technicalities of it for anybody who's interested in that.
All right. And one other thing while we're on the Edisto TV angle, and that is I understand there's an event coming up with ConnectSC and ITology. Can you tell me a bit about what's up there?
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. It's June 11th. It's up at the ITology building in Columbia. ITology, for those who don't know, is a group that's dedicated. It's a consortium. It's a nonprofit that's dedicated to bringing technology to the state of South Carolina, developing IT talent, developing technical skills in young people and adults. And so that's one thing. And then the ConnectSC group, as I mentioned last week, they're devoted to bringing high-speed broadband, high-quality high-speed broadband to every area of South Carolina. And you see that map posted up on the edisto.tv, and you see that we are severely underserved and in some cases unserved by high-speed broadband. And even folks like Atlantic Broadband, they're not going to come out this way. And they're just not going to lay cable and fiber out to these really rural areas.
All right. Well, we will keep on talking about the Edisto TV stuff. We'll certainly report back after we do the thing on June 11th. And looking forward to hearing some more of the technical details as well, you know, hopefully in small bites for my small mind.
You're listening to the Edisto TV podcast.
And as we come to the end of another Edisto TV podcast, I guess there is one other thing that I do want to talk about, and that is still planning the Blackwater event over at Aiken State Park, June 21st. I think that it's safe to say we're going to have some educational and experiential opportunities for folks to learn more and get closer to the Edisto River there on the South Fork at the State Park. And we're also going to have food, we're going to have music, and hopefully a whole bunch of people will come out and take advantage of the opportunity and show their support for the Edisto River and for rivers across South Carolina.
Yep, with the river is being cleared. Doug's been out there this week with his chainsaw trying to clear that path all the way to Cato Bridge, and it's a long way. And so we're looking at probably a 4 or 5 hour trip if somebody wants to go from Aiken State Park all the way down to Cato Bridge, but it will be quite an experience. There's nothing quite like it, so bring your boats. Doug, hi, this is Tom and Hugo from the Edisto TV podcast. How are you?
Yes, sir. Doing good. How are you doing, sir? Everything's going well today?
Yeah, pretty good. I guess if we could, just in 5 or 10 minutes, I guess number one, maybe could you give us an update on how the river's looking these days? I know you were working on trying to clear it all the way from State Park down to Cato Bridge.
We've been actually working on clearing the river from the State Park Bridge down to Cato Bridge, which would give kayakers and canoers about a day trip. It would probably be anywhere from a 4 to 6 hour trip, according to how fast you move. But we are working on that, and we've got it cleared down to the potato farm, which is not quite halfway down, but got a good bit done on the lower half, but it's a beautiful trip.
I do want to emphasize that if folks want to do that, they need to have pretty good skills. It's not a beginner's trip at all. Even with all the work y'all have done, there are going to be trees that span the river that require you to at least get out of the boat, possibly to get out of the channel of the river. You need to be physically and mentally prepared for what it's going to be. And, you know, with the water level changing, y'all did a huge amount of work with the water up the other day. But you know as well as I do, the water drops a foot or two, and there's a whole new crop of trees spanning the river that nobody's addressed. So we're going to do what we can to get that river open by the time that we have Blackwater on the 21st of June. But even then, it's not a trip for beginners, and it's not to be taken lightly, even though it is flat water.
You are exactly right, Hugo. The river, the trees there are still 6 or 8 large trees that are across the river that we will probably not be able to clear. So there's a very real possibility you will be dragging your canoe over them and or around them, and that is correct. And there are snakes in the river, so most of them are not poisonous. Most of them will not hurt you, but there are snakes around. Blackwater Fest is, something that we came up with. Hugo and Tom and myself and several others were trying to figure out a way to bring awareness that Edisto River is a beautiful river, and it is the longest free-flowing Blackwater River in North America. And it's unique. Very unique. There's no other place like it in North America, or perhaps in the world.
I want to toss in there that one of the reasons that this came up was we had so much great response with Edisto Concerns when this was just first breaking back at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, that we wanted to give a chance to all those thousands of people who got involved to come out, enjoy the river, enjoy the company of people who are so concerned about it, and enjoy some music and have a little barbecue, huh?
Amen. Have some food festival and fun, and enjoy the river, and enjoy some trips on the kayak and canoeing and whatever they want to do.
And sometime between now and the 21st of June, I am definitely going to do that. So once I've made it down on my own, I'll be able to report back to you exactly how long it took and whether or not I had any unplanned out-of-boat experiences. Okay, that's it for the Edisto TV podcast for this week. I'm Hugo.
And I'm Tom.
We'll see you next week.
For more information and archived podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.